Hello and welcome back to All My Darlings, where we are reading Harpsong for a Radical, The Life and Times of Eugene Victor Debs by Marguerite Young. And we are on chapter 21, page 67. I did get through annotating. Let's see. Oh, I think I finished. I did chapters 2 through 10. And then added those names. Chapters 11 through, I think, 15. They're more general and not broken up by chapter. They're just there in the middle. Which is fine. It's no big deal. So, yeah, I just need to catch up to this week. And I'll be caught up in putting just some links to historical people and events. Because it's just interesting, especially to me, considering that's not the history that you're told, especially in the U.S., about anything regarding socialism or communism. That all happened over there, and none of it happened here. And so she's mentioning names of people here in the U.S. that they don't get mentioned. So that was kind of cool. It's kind of neat to look at that history, that other, you know, other part of it. So the breakup of Wittling with those two Brussels sprouts, Marx and Engels, it yielded to numerous interpretations, depending on the communistic or socialistic or political or atheistic or religious bias of the interpreters. Wittling had thought that he, with his depths and heights of experience, should be the helmsman, although for Marx and Engels he was soon to emerge as nothing but a windbag and no helmsman worthy of any ship, but a ship of fools, all those who had departed from the rational philosophy of materialism that they were just then trying to work out. Wittling, with his idea that the poor children of poor workers were poured into molds, which were iron maidens from which they could be unable to emerge as flowers, was surely not, however, proposing an image of the suppression of talents with which genuine believers in the necessity of society's reform might quarrel. His trouble was that he had seemed to think of himself as the leader who, in realms of science and of art, was endowed with the eye of the omniscience, which would show him the way through titanic storms, and who had, at his beck and call, supernatural powers provided by the wisdom of his own intrinsic knowledge, which had come to his regenerative cause without abstractions of arid reasons, such as those provided by the intellectual partners Marx and Engels, for whom errant utopian dreamers were guilty of throwing dust into the eyes of whatever benighted mechanics and millwrights and wheelwrights should make the egregious mistake of joining with him to go where they knew not. Neither Marx nor Engels had dug ditches or plowed lands. In Wittling's somewhat biased or jaundiced view, these two would be fathers of the International Workingmen's Association, who were hammering out the shape and design of the revolutionary communist movement, might turn out not to be good fathers of the lowly mechanics and sowers and reapers for whom he was the spokesman, for he had been one of them. His belief was that Marx, with his excessive erudition, might make an excellent lexicographer, but never the founder of a utopian world that might be habitable by men. He had had no room in his baggage for Neo-Hegelianism. He had only his own utopian scrolls and perhaps an angel's foot or an angel's spare wing. Shortly after his rupture with a couple with whom he had never been united, he was to sail for the first time to that America which Hegel had dismissed as a continent outside history, but which Marx, reflecting Engels, and Engels, reflecting Marx, knew was a continent within history and could not be left out. There were numerous eyewitnesses to tentative relationships at a time when everything was tentative, and Marx was in love with his own crystal ball gazing, his own spirit of prophecy in his own way, as Wittling was with his, which accepted only his own forecast. The well-hatted, well-tailored, well-gloved, and well-buttoned Taylor King genuinely believed that it was he who was chosen to preside over intricate networks of primitive Christian earthly paradises. This occurred because of his swift refusal to accept any law other than his own and that of God, doubtless for the very good reason that he was the worker Christ, who was the Son of God and had arisen. His carpenter's owl was his all. He had now become in his own eyes the master tailor who, when others could not see an inch before their faces through the fog caused by human stupidity, could see how to draw his thread through the needle's eye gleaming through seas of clouds. President Brussels at this time, along with others exiled by various crowns, had been Joseph Weidemeyer, a former officer in the Prussian artillery, who was very good at spotting rebels against the iron heels of the Iron King, and at a time when, as a disciple of the utopian philosophies of Owen and Fourier, he had found that he was in a situation of unendurable paradox through the fact that he was a rebel who ought to be spotting himself, and had withdrawn to become a railroad construction engineer, his skill being such that he knew how many dynamite sticks would be required to blow up the locomotive and the rails when there came the coming revolution. The eyewitness Wiedemeyer was to remember random card games at night in Brussels with Marx and Engels. With himself as the third hand, had sometimes been joined by Wittling dropping in as the fourth hand. He was always the first to grow weary, the first to drop out. It would be remembered of him. It had been Engels' belief that Wittling's refusal to participate in the strategy of the new communist doctrine had been caused by not only his illusions of grandeur, but by his anxiety over money. Money, it seemed, was required in order to found a moneyless utopia, albeit, as the jackass Wittling said to all and sundry, it was or should be of less value than the dung which made the crops grow. He was greedy. From Engels's naturally unbiased point of view, this mournful but optimistic jester with bells did seem an irresponsible mont blanc. A man made all of motley, many biases, and many angles and scraps and shreds. But to Wittling, the gamblers, Marx, and Engels, who were so interrelated that they seemed able to read each other's minds and also each other's cards, were guilty of blackmailing anyone who did not agree with them and were determined to put him off the rails of history, throw him aside. Wittling's objection to Marx and Engels, as he had leapt up to say one night in Marx's house, where the various revolutionary exiles were gathered at a table drinking wine, as they considered the way from the old world of despotic capitalism to the new world of political and economic equality, which should be brought by following their chart, was that their schemes were wholly unnecessary. He had already worked everything out and would be the pilot star providing guidance because of his relationship with God and man. Marx, arising to his feet, had brought his fist down so hard upon the table that the goblets of red wine reflecting candle flames and candlesticks had jumped, Marx had ringingly declared, as would be recalled by the visiting Russian P.V. and Annenikov, that the arousal of fantastic hopes in the breast of workers such as those in which Wilhelm Wittling indulged could only lead to the ultimate ruin and not to the salvation of the oppressed. Wittling's attempt to lead workers without a scientific basis from the old world to the new was considered by both Marx and Engels to be as false and dishonest a game as playing preacher to a congregation of jackasses, listening with their mouths agape. Wittling, with his utopian bundle, was or was soon to be revealed as a utopian bindlestiff, like many utopian bindlestiff who had gone before him and would come after him. He was guilty of promising to deliver the goods he could not deliver, not even in America, where the millennial dream seemed to fail, only seemed to fail. One of the projects on which Wittling had worked while living as a tailor reformer in London, Soho, as he continued to try to develop the perfect lathe, was the invention or evolvement of a new universal language such as had been, along with secret and occult languages and languages of silent signs, a part of many utopian ideals, although it almost always perished before it could be put on wings and get it off its feet. If all mankind was or was to become one body, and if all things, instead of being disjointed, were recognized as a part of a single and unified and endless whole, as Owen with his dream of a universal language had also believed, and surely that language must be the simple carrier of simple thoughts, then why should men and nations be alienated from each other by the failure of communication? Oh, good, the trash is here. We have holidays, and when we have holidays, the trash misses a day, and we're all thrown off our schedule. But they're here, so that's good. According to Wittling's new language, the German Du wirst das Mädchen haben, which in English translated into You Will Have the Girl, was to become, when all tongues should be the same tongue, the instantly apprehensible Pi-Papai-Lisas, to give but one example of the harmony, which was to replace discord. What if to some ears Pi-Papai-Lisas had a ridiculous sound? To its creator, it was as sublime as the music of the universe. Ich werde das Mädchen gehabt haben, I will have had the girl, became Pi Papai Sas. Ich werde ein Mann werden, I will become a man, Pi Wafififif. The hissing sounds of the old Westphalian seemed not to have departed from the universal tongue in which all bird workers would speak in the earthly paradise which was to come. Wittling was never to be in agreement with Jacob Grimm of the Grimm Brothers fairy tales, whom Karl Marx did grimly read for the beaming light which, in the midst of the foggy darkness, and in the midst of much dead history which somehow lived, it cast upon the study of language is that which was more than the study of words, 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 which are not merely birds, 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 but a means of spading up and exploring man's past, whether immediate or remote. Of all the things which man had created, language remained, according to Jacob Grimm's tracery of the origin of language, mankind's noblest possession. In a universe filled with the roarings of waves upon all shores, far and near, dogs barking, birds singing, man's language was that creation which God had given to him with his ability to think. Wittling, to whom words like birds had provided liberation, could not forgive Grimm's questioning of the divine authenticity of the biblical tale of the Tower of Babel, which was built upon a plain in the land of Shinar by bricklayers and stonemasons and mortar bearers, when the whole earth was made of one language and of one speech. And the Lord had come down to see what was built by the children of men, but had feared that as the people were of one language, nothing could restrain them from doing what they wished to do, even from building a tower from earth to heaven. So he had scattered them all over the face of the earth before they could build a city, and he had split the once universal language into various tongues. In his passion for shaving things down with his Occam's razor and the quest for what would be irrational clarity beyond dispute and which would open the door to the future, Wittling, with the thickening fogs heavily increasing on him, had probably not understood that he was throwing himself against God's towers of Babel, trying to knock it down, trying to undo God's work, as if it were the work of the despotic powers of state who wanted poor men to be divided from each other. The simplified spelling of words in one tongue must have seemed to him as necessary a part of his evangelical socialism, as was the gospel of which the root contained the word spell, from which spelling came. In overcoming diversities of tongues, he would be going back to the original word of God. He would be doing so in modern times. It mistakenly seemed to Wittling, almost beyond the power of his conception, that any man would be so obtuse as to fail to see that his simple Simon language, if such it was, provided possibilities of clear and unequivocal communication linking the earthly paradises of the world. Wittling's new universal language, which never did get off its feet, could only seem as abrasive as sand to sensitive ears, and had seemed to Engels, and hence possibly also to Marx, unutterably ridiculous. Wittling was a tailor's dummy. He seemed nothing more, perhaps. When he was in London, devoting himself to the ironing of straw for fashionable poke bonnets and the design of his futuristic lathe, while continuing his writings as he dreamed of the Rousseau green forest in which man had dwelt in happiness before his loss of that primitive innocence to which he should be returned, Wittling has sometimes attended meetings of workingmen in their institutes and had joined in their choral singing around a piano, and delivered lectures on the forms and shapes that would prevail in the world which was to come when the utopian ideal of the cooperative brotherhoods would be made real. Charles Dickens was also an important figure in the history of British and American socialism. Dickens was the profligate author of Martin Chuzzlewit, in which he had given a most unflattering and not oval portrait of America as made up of an entire society in which people lived at the thin surface, hiding the profound void and dependent upon hyperbolic language is a substitution for the bleakness and bareness of their reality that they hid from themselves and thus they hoped from others. America was the place where theft was called independence. Ooh, that's a good one. The tarring and feathering of political opponent in Lonely Gulch was called the planting of the standard of civilization in the wilder gardens of the American continent. Reality was taken away or left behind by such dazzling claims as the American was a child of nature and a child of freedom, by his boastful claim to the despot and the tyrant that his bright home was in the setting sun. Dickens had not thought that such cupidity was confined to the Americans, who in public wore masks like those of puppets to conceal their inner emptiness, many having come to the new land as migrants themselves, who, when they had made good by all kinds of confidence games, all kinds of crooked deals, stacked cards, and loaded dice, had blotted out from their minds, for the most part, recognition or memory of the sufferings of fellow migrants who had been and remained homeless urchins in the mud. Many of life's most essential measurements were those that were measured by no measuring yardstick, but that which gauged the size of a man by dollars in his pot of silver or gold. For Dickens, it did seem that the only way from earth to heaven was the way which, in its many windings, led from life to death. And Paper Pills, we are on Blue Sky. So if you, they're doing a group read of Harpsong for a Radical starting October 1st. I know I'm ahead. I know you, because I'm doing this in September. But I am not sharing it out on social media or talking about it in any way, because I'm waiting for October 1st. And then I'll go back and do the, so if people don't want to, if people don't have a physical copy to read the book, they can podcast the book if they want to. But the discussion and everything, see the book talk with Paper Pills is on Blue Sky. That's an app that you need to download. And I think because it's in beta, there's a special, you need a request. They need to get a code in order to get in. And she was able to get me one. And I'm sure either you can contact her or contact me. I think I'm on there as To All My Darlings. No, I'm on there as MMMD by MY. Because anything else was too long. That was the shortest name they took. And then I think my on-screen name might be To All My Darlings. I'm not sure. But anyways, Paper Pills or myself, if you find her, you'll find me, because we're following each other. Request a code if you want to join up for the October 1st read-along. We're using hashtag, she's using hashtag MYoung23. I think there's about 8 of us so far. And let her know to add you. And we generally, I don't know what the reading schedule is. I don't know how many chapters or how she's splitting up the book. Cause it's roughly almost 600 pages. So I don't know any of that. But I'm sure she'll let us know, as we get closer to October 1st. And yeah, it's a lot of fun. People, you know, read and then share out passages that really, stuck out to them. And we just share stuff in order to, share the hashtag in order to promote it. I think they're doing Finnegan's Wake and Joyce every day or something like that. But anyways, it will be fun. So I'll be talking about that from here on out, because that's going to take up the majority of the podcast for the rest of this year. All right. As always, thank you for listening. Have a wonderful time wherever you are. Bye.